Today is Tuesday, June 23rd, 2020. This is part 11 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charles Butch Farabee, F-A-R-A-B-E-E. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Butch. How are you today?
Good, Tom. Yourself?
Good. Thank you so much for carrying on this amazing series of interviews of your life with the National Park Service. May we have your permission to record this interview over the phone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much. At the end of the last interview, you had talked quite a bit about some of your duties there at Yosemite, as far as your administrative duties. What are the sort of things did you do for fun?
Well, okay. So, I did a lot of climbing, and I had a family, although I talked last time about sort of ignoring that, I suppose. Ignoring is not the right word, but not doing as well as I should have. But one of the things that I thought about since we last talked is that in high school I was an all-state swimmer, freestyle mostly. And I was a pretty fair swimmer, and so I actually was able to get myself and then other rangers, at least temporarily, into the police, fire, Olympics community. And in California, that's a pretty big deal, actually, with so many municipalities and agencies. And, of course, there are a lot of avocational and maybe semi-professional athletes among policemen and firemen, as you can imagine. So, as much law enforcement as we did in Yosemite, and I was right in the middle of all that, and anybody that knew could understand how much law enforcement we were doing. I made a real effort and was successful. I went to the various board members of the California State Police Olympic Committee. I'm not sure if that's the exact title, but close to it. And there was a board of maybe 8 or 10. And I got hold of a policeman from, I believe it was Oakland. And since Oakland's fairly close to Yosemite, and there's a lot of stories that would be in the San Francisco area papers, newspapers, about all the mayhem and police kinds of activities in Yosemite, I thought that person would be pretty understanding,
right,
and would have some sense as to what rangers did in law enforcement. But this had nothing to do with the Park Service per se. It's just that I was able to capitalize on that. So I went to them. He said, yeah, I don't have any problem with it. If you can convince the same, these other guys. And I said, do you mind if I use your name? And he said, no, that's fine. And so I ended up spending an inordinate amount of time, I mean, over a period of several weeks, getting all of these guys. And after the first 4 or 5 that said, yeah, but if you can get the other guy to get hold. So I ended up getting however many, 8 or 10 of these guys to, allow rangers to compete. Well,
were they on some sort of oversight board or something?
No, they were just the committee, the board that managed, several thousand, 3,000 or 4,000 at least competitors in everything from track to skeet to equestrian stuff, which I'll tell you about in a moment. Baseball and swimming and almost every sport you can think of, probably not football or anything like that, and mostly individual sports stuff, archery. And so it was just an oversight board might be, but it was a governing board but they had to give permission, which they ended up, I don't know if they sent me a letter or something, but I ended up having, permission, And it wasn't so much me per se as much as permission for the ranger, you know, the law enforcement ranger part of me, to be considered sufficiently law enforcement in order to compete. So anyway, I went, I competed there. And
did you bring anyone else from the park with you?
Well, so yes, that's a so, but not on that first occasion.
Okay.
And maybe not even the second occasion, but pretty early on, I believe it was 1976, there was a competition in Santa Ana, and I think it was like the fourth or sixth, maybe even longer, annual gathering. And this would be a week-long series of events and, you know, putting together competition with maybe 10 or 12 different venues by several thousand competitors who would come into town from other parts of the state.
Wow.
It was really kind of a big deal for them. I mean, it's a lot of effort. This wouldn't be something you just do overnight. And, you know, sponsorships and, you know, professional liaisons with the various chiefs of police and sheriffs of various big counties and that sort of thing. So, and of course, that's a national and international thing now. And to some degree probably was then, but on a lesser scale. So about 1976 or 77, I conned my other ranger friends, three of them that I worked with, Rick Smith, Mark Forbes, and Tim Setnica, into competing with me to go. So we all went to Santa Ana. We took our wives or girlfriends with us. And Tim was a All-American swimmer in Indiana, in high school. So, and I wasn't an All-American, but I was, you know, I was pretty fair. And Rick had swum, and well, Rick and, and Mark both had swum in college. So, you know, we were a relatively strong team, and we went down as mostly just for me, you know, to get a T-shirt, really. So. And I swam, so we put together two relay teams, and then Tim and I swam independently as well. Mark and Rick just were part of the two relay teams. So we walk in, and we've got our Pine Pig T-shirts on that, you know, it's probably not as prevalent now as it was in the 70s, but PIG, pig, was a often a derogatory term for police. And then over time, it got turned around, and pig started standing for pride, integrity, and guts, PIG. So we got our Pine Pig T-shirts on, and it's a caricature of a pine pig, which you have to sort of see in order to understand what it was. But so we've got our matching Pine Pig T-shirts on, and we think we're sort of hot stuff. And we go into the swimming venue, which is a nice pool, and there's probably a couple of hundred people, you know, in the stands, or, you know, including our wives and their wives and everybody else's wives. And women could compete as well, but there were more men competing. And, you know, we're in good shape, and we think we're pretty hot stuff. And we walk out there, and here, I thought we were doing good until this team from the Los Angeles Harbor, the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department Harbor Patrol.
Oh, wow.
And these guys all look like they're about 7 feet high and broad-shouldered, and they probably were starting quarterbacks on their college football team or something.
Wow.
And they've got their T-shirts on that say Los Angeles Sheriff's Department Harbor Patrol or Orange County Harbor Patrol, something like that. And there were I think 10 teams, not counting individual swimmers, but you know just 10 relay teams of various things. And we did okay. I mean, we didn't embarrass ourselves. We came in about number 5, about middle of the pack.
Okay.
And so I continued to do that swim both in California and then once I got to the Grand Canyon, both in Arizona and Nevada. But the one last thing about the competition in California was, I think roughly 1979 or so, I went through a National Park Service riding, horseback riding, equitation school that the park put on for 6 weeks. And pretty much 8 to 5, I was riding and working with patrol horses. And I've mentioned several times about the patrol horses that we had at the Grand Canyon, not the Grand Canyon, I'm sorry, at in Yosemite.
Right.
Which were pretty not unique, but, you know, very, well, I can't even think of the right word, but they were very well considered, and they actually worked with the President of the United States on occasion. So they were thought of pretty highly. Well, I was a, you know, when I was on the trail crew in Yosemite, or no, in Sequoia and Kings Canyon while I was still going to school, and then I owned my own quarter horse. And again, I thought I was pretty good as a horseman, and you know, I was okay, but I wasn't any great shakes, not as good as I thought I was. So I went through the 6-week school taught by or held or hosted by the park's old cowboy wrangler, a guy by the name of Walt Castle, C-A-S-T-L-E. And so I go through the school, and the guy that's a horse patrol supervisor at that time, his name is Charles, quote, Butch Wilson. He and I had this wild hair of, I'm going to go swim in Oakland, and why not take one of the patrol horses and compete in the,
oh, wow,
in the California's Police Olympics equitation thing. So we got permission from the chief ranger. We took a patrol horse over. And I went to swim, and he trailered over. He brought his family, and he trailered over one of the one horse. We didn't take two horses, just one horse. And the horse was the Cadillac of our patrol horses. I mean, you could just think about doing certain moves, and that horse would respond. So we meet the night before where we're supposed to, you know, stable the horse where the competition is, which is in a rodeo ring. And the first guy we talked to that night when we were putting the horse up, you know, so what's sort of the deal here? Because we really had no idea what we were doing, and we thought that we should be doing this in our uniforms. So, you know, we brought our green Levi's and Park Service gray shirts and badges and stuff. So he says, no, you know, he says the competition is by professional rodeo standards. And that's not the right title, but it's, you know, it's at a certain, there is a certain requirement, certain level that we had to adhere to, and which one was, we needed to dress the part, sort of. And so we ran down to Walmart, and we got some cowboy button shirts with pearls on them, you know, pearl button shirts. And so we met the next morning, and these are all policemen. We thought it would be policemen who used their horses on duty. That's, you know, I guess I wasn't paying much attention. But as it turns out, there are policemen who are just cowboys on the weekend.
Huh.
Or who are competitors. I don't want to say that quite cowboys like that, but right, they were competitors. And so they were full-time sheriff's deputies and policemen and what have you, but they were there because they liked horses and liked to ride and what have you. Well, that's okay. So we show up the next morning. We talk to the, you know, there's a group of about 30 riders And not everybody's going to ride in every event, but we get permission from these 30 other policemen. One of us, either Butch or myself, asks the group in this group meeting, sort of laying out the rules and the things that we're supposed to know about, does anybody mind if we use the same horse? Everybody said, that's fine, because they really didn't know who the heck we were, and they could see the hay sticking out of our hair, the hay seeds that have come in. And they said, that's fine. And so then we borrowed a cowboy hat, one hat, from one of these guys. And I think that, I sort of found out who the fastest gun in town was, the guy that had done the best, say, the year before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm engaging him in a little conversation. And again, he knows about the Rangers and the parks, but he doesn't think we're much of a threat to him. So what do we do on this first event? What's it like, tricks of the trade? And so he gave me some shortcuts and things to keep in mind and what have you. And everybody drew straws, or not straws, drew numbers. And I was like number 8, and my fellow ranger was maybe number 15. So I would, whatever the event was that we were both going to be in, I would be first and he would be after me. So we agreed that we would cue the horse, say, like riding the barrels or keyhole race or whatever, that we would cue the horse the same way, so that the horse already had some remembrance of what I did, and so he could do it better, right?
Yeah.
So the first time out of the gate, literally, practically almost, we went like first and third.
Wow.
And Butch is number 1, and I'm number 3 or 4. Well, to make a real long story short, we end up, after each of us have competed in maybe 8 to 10 events, we have won 4 or 5 first places, a number of second places, a whole bunch of thirds and fourths. And after about the second or third time of asking this fastest gun in town, so what's some of the tricks of the trade? He pretty much stopped, wouldn't give us the time of day.
Oh.
Now, and then Butch and I would switch. We only had one pair of spurs between us, so we'd end up switching spurs, and we'd swap hats, and we'd go out, and, the announcer would announce, number 1 from Yosemite National Park is Butch Wilson, number 3 is Butch Barabee from Yosemite National Park, and that it almost became embarrassing. And we actually did very well for ourselves, and so in my garage, I've got a small box full of medals from all these police Olympics, not only California, but from Nevada and Arizona. So I just thought that was kind of a fun thing to mention. You asked about.
Did that get written up in any way so the rest of the staff at Yosemite could kind of be proud of, what you guys were doing, representing the park there?
Not that I really remember. I mean, it went, other rangers knew about all of this stuff.
Oh, fun.
I did write an article for our in-house magazine on the Pine Pig T-shirt, and the subject was these Pine Pig T-shirts. It was sort of a look back in time kind of a thing. But I did send in, I had the photo of the 4 of us swimming in our swimming suits with our Pine Pig T-shirts on, and told the story about these 7-foot-tall...
Harbor guys.
Quarterback. I don't know if they all were quarterbacks, but they look like they could have been, right? So, okay, I'm going to sort of shut up about that.
Well, that was fun. How was it that you ended up leaving Yosemite?
Actually, I was getting a quick drink here. Well, I've been there 9.5 years. I was up at Mather District, M-A-T-H-E-R, and Mather's named after the first director of the National Park Service, Stephen T. Mather. So, you know, as much as I knew I liked being in the field, I also knew that, you know, I got to keep sort of working my way up the management totem pole. And at the time, I was a GS-11. And Dick Marks, I had interacted with, you know, while in Yosemite, but he moved on, and I never had any real contact with him. I mean, it wasn't like we were buddies or anything.
Uh-huh.
I went to a gathering in Yosemite, in Grand Canyon. This is while I'm still in Yosemite, but I went to a training, I think, and one of the staff of the training center, the Horace M. Albright Training Center to Grand Canyon, had a gathering one night, and Marks was there, the superintendent was there, and he pulled me aside, and he said his current assistant chief ranger, a guy by the name of Dick McLaren, that's M-C-E-C-L-A-R-E-N, I think there's two C's, McLaren, and who actually in Park Service circles, he and his two brothers all were rangers.
So that's M-C-C-L.
Capital C. Actually, I'm wrong, Tom. I think it's, you know, Mac, M-C.
Okay.
Then capital L-A-R-E-N. I think it's McLaren. I don't think there are two C's. I think I was wrong.
Thank you.
Now that I think about it. And he was the assistant chief ranger, and his background really was in fire. That was his forte, pretty well respected in those days as a firefighter, would be on these, what now would be an incident management team at a high level. But there were some other things that he was doing that weren't all that good, and he was retiring. So Dick March pulled me aside at this little party and said, I want you to apply for this job. Well, there's nothing wrong with Grand Canyon, right? I mean, you know, I'm in Yosemite. I've been there 9.5 going into 10 years. It's a promotion for me. It's a GS-12. It's got a whole lot of other responsibilities. It's a good time to move on and take on bigger and better responsibilities and what have you.
And how old were you at the time? So it was 1979?
Well, so that would have been, no, this is actually 1981.
Okay.
Well, it might have been like late 1980 when the actual request came through. So, but at the time I was out at Mather, so I would have been, what would I have been, 38, I guess.
Okay.
Maybe, huh? And he says, I want you to apply for this job. So the announcement, job announcement came out. I applied, and I was told later on by my boss at the time, the chief ranger, I had two bosses, you know, two chief rangers while I was there, and the second was Ken Miller, but that's not the name I'm trying to come up with right at the moment.
This is at Grand Canyon or at Yosemite?
Oh, Grand Canyon.
Okay.
He told me years later, he said, you know, you were like a one-name selection. He said, Marks told me to pick you. And that sort of thing wasn't unusual, but it wasn't typical either. I mean, it wasn't like anybody that applied for a job, it was already a foregone conclusion. Hmm. But there was some of that.
And Marks was new to Grand Canyon. Did he show up in 79 or 80? And so he was still building his team.
He was pretty new. And I think you're right. I'm not, I don't know. I can look it up, I think, but I don't know for sure. But he was fairly new to Grand Canyon at that point. And he was building a team, but he was also, in this case, you know, his assistant chief ranger, which had, I oversaw both wildland and structural fire. the aviation program, we had a helicopter full-time, 24/7, which was a contract, but with the Grand Canyon helicopters, but our helicopter was stationed in the park. And I had search and rescue. I had a couple of paramedics. I had a EMS. I had the communication center, and I had the law enforcement office. Not so much law enforcement, you know, that other rangers did, but the law enforcement specialist, who was an investigator, if you will, and he had another person on his, you know, that worked for him as well. So, you know, it was a pretty key operation. The only thing I didn't really do was oversee the district rangers, and the district rangers would oversee the actual patrolmen and fee collectors and backcountry operations and okay. the river. So, and the chief ranger oversaw those, and I oversaw the rest that I just mentioned a moment ago. So Marks asked me to apply for this job. I got the job. And in March of 1981, I moved to the Grand Canyon. My family and I moved. My son was in kindergarten. My youngest son, Adam, was not in school yet. And at that point, was small enough that he didn't have any, you know, real close friends,
mm-hmm.
And nor did my youngest or my oldest son either. So that part wasn't that much of a hardship. You know, it was a promotion. It was, with my thinking, if I don't make a move to get out of Yosemite pretty quickly, mm-hmm. I may not get out of here.
Right.
And as much fun as I was having there, I did know that, you know, I wanted to broaden my horizons a little bit, so... So anyway, that's how I got to the Grand Canyon, I guess.
So what were your first impressions of Dick Marks? What can you tell me about him as a superintendent or as an individual?
Well, I thought, you know, Dick had an interesting reputation. He had some reputation as a field ranger background, and he used to tout that. I think took some pride in that, and probably justifiably so. I don't pretend to be any expert on Dick Marks. I do think that you know, he was a pretty fair manager in many ways. He was a good, pretty good politician. He knew which side the bread was buttered on, but. You know, on a day-to-day basis, I didn't have too much interaction with them. But having said that, you know, I had enough visible programs that I oversaw and was involved with, and I was really a hands-on manager and supervisor that, you know, I was in his eye a fair amount, I think. But... you know, on a day-to-day basis, whenever we would see each other, either socially, sort of, or at least off-duty, and it wasn't like we socialized in the same circles, probably, but, you know, when you live in a little community like the South Rim, there's a lot of overlap with going-away parties and Christmas parties and various meetings that I participated in. He, you know, was very pleasant, was, you know, socially very, was good. His wife has, H-A-Z, and I don't really know what that, maybe Hazel, perhaps, I'm not sure. But she was a real sweetheart. She was a nurse by training, by education. And I think, actually, while they were working, although I don't know about the Grand Canyon, but, you know, she had been a nurse along through her life as well. I don't know if I'm rattling about.
No, I was thinking this is good for background. And who was your boss? Who was the chief ranger when you showed up?
Well, so that's, his name is Gary, G-A-O-I, Kuiper, K-U-I-P-E-R, Kuiper. And he was my first immediate supervisor.
Okay.
He was the chief ranger at the time. Have you heard that name before?
No, not at all. What can you tell me about him?
Well, he was, he'd been there for several years, for sure. He was, a good guy. I thought he was a pretty fair manager. We got along very well. The only thing that I know of any real controversy that he created was sort of unknowingly, there was a fatality on the river, and he went in with somebody else, and they ended up moving the body. And the sheriff at the time, and this is, a guy by the name of Joe Richards, got pretty upset about that. And the sheriff and the county and the park always had this love-hate relationship. And Sheriff Joe, who I interacted with a whole bunch, I mean, there's probably, this will probably come out here at some point, but he really didn't like the fact that Gary had moved this body. And it was totally inadvertent, but it was not very professional either on Gary's part. It wasn't malicious in any sense. It was just sort of sloppy, I think, on their part.
And you guys, you guys had done that. You guys had been trained in death investigation, and if he missed that class, maybe they saw there was a reason. I don't know. I'm speaking out of turn.
Well, not really. My training I mentioned before was really OJT.
Okay.
And I put together that death investigation class for a week, but by absolutely no stretch of any kind of imagination were any of us, in Yosemite, even though we were deputized as coroners, any kind of an expert. And at the Grand Canyon, it's a different jurisdiction.
Okay.
In Yosemite, it was exclusive, or essentially exclusive. And at the Grand Canyon, it was concurrent. And that's a big deal in the Park Service with from a legal standpoint and how laws are and rules are adjudicated and reviewed. Because, it's all done within the jurisdictions that you have. And the park had an agreement, an MOU with the two counties,
Mojave
and Grand and Coconino.
Okay.
On how to, what to do and this sort of thing, and who has what jurisdictions and who can have what authorities and whatever. And at this time, Gary moved this body, and I'm not trying to make a big deal out of it, but in a small circle, that was kind of a big issue with the sheriff. And it certainly didn't hurt the relationship between the county. It didn't help the relationship between the county and the park. And so Gary, I thought, was a good supervisor and I think a pretty good manager. And then about a year after I got there, he ended up becoming superintendent up at what is now, it's either Lake Roosevelt or Roosevelt in Washington State. It's a big lake recreation area.
Hmm.
Marks was my superintendent the whole time I was there.
Yeah, who replaced Gary?
So Ken Miller.
Okay.
M-I-L-L-E-R. I'll replace Gary.
M-I-L-L-E-R.
Correct.
Okay.
And Ken I actually met him when I was on about a week-long detail up to Lassen National Park, which actually has some real interest at some point for you, I think. So I met him, and he was the law enforcement specialist in Sequoia at one time. I'm not sure he came from there to Yosemite to Grand Canyon, but he had more of a law enforcement background. I think he actually was one of the very, very, very tippy-top first five Rangers to go through a federal government-sponsored police school, which, when it started out, was under the United States Park Police. And, you know, we were short of them just say Park Police School, but it was held in D.C., and the U.S. United States Park Police has sort of come under hard review here lately.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, and I don't want to denigrate them particularly, but, you know, he was one of the first five Rangers to go through the school. So he had come up through sort of a law enforcement field background. And he was there the whole time I was there. And then when I moved on to Washington, D.C., he was still there. And I'm pretty sure he ended up retiring from there, actually.
Okay.
So. What else did I tell you about Gary or Ken, or do you?
Well, just as we go along, it'd be good to know more of them as you remember things. I was also kind of wondering, who was the special investigator at the time?
So, Lloyd Hohner, H-O-E-N-E-R, was the park's law enforcement specialist. And I don't know that that's all capitalized, but that was his position. And he was the person that would coordinate training and law enforcement. And
was he an older gentleman?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. You know, tall, thin, quite a runner. He was really, I think running was his primary interest, and then working as a ranger was his secondary interest. And I inherited him, and he was not all that effective. And the superintendent was willing and sort of interested in trying to have me help him move along or retire. And I could see, and I oversaw him. I supervised him. And then there was another ranger after that, Dave Swickert, that I supervised that took his place. But initially it was Lloyd Hohner. And Lloyd was interested in, just wasn't a very, very effective, and he was sort of an old school ranger that had somewhat, you know, semi-retired in place. So,
how do you spell Dave's last name?
S-W-I-C-K-A-R-D, Swickard.
Thank you.
And he, after I left, and probably some shortcoming that I performed, he ends up getting himself in real trouble after I leave.
This is Lloyd, or this is Dave?
No, this is Dave Swickard.
Well, let's go back to Lloyd for a minute.
Yeah.
Who was not very effective. So then what happened?
So, well, I just would look over Lloyd's shoulders, and I take some pride in that I was a fair manager, a probably more than tolerant kind of a supervisor. I wasn't, you know, in the terms of like a ranger. I wasn't really a hard ass. So, but I would make sure that Lloyd's T's were crossed and the I's were dotted and that he was doing what he was supposed to do.
Okay.
You know, he was probably pretty close to retiring anyway. So within, I'm guessing now maybe 6 months or so, he ends up retiring to Flagstaff. And I think he's still in Flagstaff. I think he's still alive.
Hmm.
Although I wouldn't swear to that either, of course. But I don't know anything about his real background. I didn't know much about his family, although I'm sure at the time I knew, but I certainly don't recall much of that at all. But anyway, Lloyd ends up retiring. And his assistant at the time was this Dave Swickard, S-W-I-C-K-A-R-D, Swickard. was married, no kids, of course, lived in the park. He, I guess I promoted him. I guess, I mean, I'm sure that I did. He became the law enforcement specialist, or the like a GS-11, I believe, in that function. And Dave oversaw the communication center, as well as one other investigator, or, you know, criminal, you know, somebody that more focused on law enforcement than, you know, regular rangers did. And, you know, Dave was a very sociable person, had a lot of contacts, knew people in the sheriff's office, and knew people in the company, which I thought was a pretty good benefit for the operation.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed his ability, and I enjoyed his counsel. I was pretty open about saying, Dave, well, what do you think about doing this, you know, and he'd give me his answer, then I might make a decision pro or con, but I certainly wasn't against any of his advice or his counsel, which generally I thought was pretty fair. I didn't have any real questions about his abilities. His interest mostly was in law enforcement and guns. He was a gun guy. I'm not much of a gun guy.
Right. Didn't he have a lathe? Did he would repair weapons.
You sort of cut out there. What was that?
I was thinking that didn't Lloyd, wasn't he a gunsmith as well?
Lloyd might have been, yes. I mean, that sort of rings a bell. That's not something that jumped into my mind firsthand.
But, okay.
Well, I'm not sure I have too much to add on to whatever.
Well, you're just talking about Dave Swickard.
Well, Dave was married, no kids, nice guy. Mostly his focus was in law enforcement. Perhaps had worked in one other park before Grand Canyon. Didn't have much of a real broad view of the Park Service, but that wasn't really a hindrance of any sort. And he ends up being my go-to person when I would need some advice or counsel on, you know, law enforcement matters. He wasn't a politician. If there were any politics involved, I was the one that would be handling most of that. He had good broad relationships with, you know, some key players with the company at the Grand Canyon at the time, the main concessioner. He probably had a few good relationships with some of the sheriff's deputies that worked for mostly Coconino County. He was really interested in guns. I mean, it wasn't like that was his main life, but he would set up the training for, we would have to qualify with our handguns and with a shotgun twice a year. And he would set up those training exercises. And years after I left, he ends up getting himself into real trouble. He ends up getting some real malfeasance with involving guns and maybe sales of guns and doing some things that were very shady, I think even illegal. And if he had been doing this while he was working for me, I did not see it. Perhaps I should have. Guess I'm assuming that if I did see any of this kind of wrongdoing, I would have pulled him up short and dealt with it at the time. But I don't recall seeing it. And sometimes I am naive and have maybe too much faith in my fellow people.
Hmm.
But he ends up getting himself removed. I don't know that he ever did any time in a prison. I do know that I'm pretty sure I know this, that his pension, years that he put into the Park Service, were done away with. You know, he lost that.
Wow.
So it was a serious enough set of circumstances to promote him being removed and prosecuted sort of internally, at least, from the Park Service.
Wow. Butch, you mentioned dispatch, what I sort of call the communications center. Where was that at the time when you showed up?
So it was, I don't know what the term is anymore, but in my day in the 80s and the 70s, it was at the visitor center,
okay,
which was also Park headquarters in those days, right next to the cemetery.
Yep.
And I think now it's only just, it's not a visitor center anymore, of course, and it's strictly business offices. But dispatch was back in the rear part of that building.
Okay.
It was a 24/7 operation. This was before 911, and it was also, you know, not only was it a dispatch center, but it was the telephone operations thing where people would call looking for information, and a receptionist would send that phone call to wherever,
okay,
if necessary. So I don't remember how many people worked in there, but, you know, let's say roughly, you know, for 24/7, there might have been 7 or 8 people assigned to that, you know, in there.
And your offices, were they at the Ranger Operations Building?
So my office, the chief ranger and the assistant chief ranger and the unit, the backcountry supervisor or district ranger, the district ranger for the South Rim, were all in ranger operations. You know, I can visualize it. I can't tell you what the name of the street or anything is anymore.
So this is Center, where the stop sign is, where the end of the train tracks are, next to...
Well, it's on the
right.
south side of the train tracks, sort of directly opposite of the Altavar.
Right, right across the street from the general store.
Well, the old general store.
Yeah, from the old general store.
Correct.
And the post office, the old post office,
yep,
and the old magistrate's area.
Yep, that's correct.
Okay.
And I had an office on the first floor, chief ranger on the first floor. Barb Horning was the secretary for most of that time, was on the first floor. The district ranger for the South Rim was on the first floor. Second floor was the head of the river unit and the backcountry, which is sort of just getting off the ground a little bit. We're upstairs.
Who was the head?
There isn't that much room. It's a really neat building.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't remember. Is that a CCC building? Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was the original park kind of headquarters.
Well, No, I think you're correct there as well. That would make it before CCC.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Who was the head of the river operations at the time?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me that. Well, a couple of people that come to mind, but these are not necessarily chronologically correct. Marv Jensen was a unit manager. It's almost on the tip of my tongue as well. Was the first one when I was there, and that doesn't help you at all because I can't remember his name, but. You know, I can't tell you right now, Tom.
No worries, no worries. I'm drawing a blank too. I can see the guy's face.
Who I'm thinking about is Bob Yearout.
Okay.
And I think he was the, and then Steve Martin was right behind him in there.
Yep.
Steve was a sort of a river runner himself at the time, but you know, a ranger river runner, and he. But I think Bob Yearout was first, and then I think Steve might have been in there before, and then Marv Jensen was there. And Marv ends up being my immediate supervisor between Gary Kuiper and Ken Miller, and this is also the time that I'm going through into a divorce, and I turn into a real mediocre employee. I mean, I'm keeping my head above water from several different perspectives. At that point, I'm a single father. My wife has left me, et cetera. And so I'm really pretty devastated. So I'm having a hard time balancing all the balls at one time.
Hmm.
And, you know, Marv was good to me. I think he understood what the hell I was doing or not doing. And so I think of all the many, many, you know, however many 30 years worth of employee evaluations, that's the one time in my life when I ended up getting a level 3, which would be just passing, be just mediocre grades, if you will. So, but Marv was there. Kurt Sauer would have been in there as well. And again, as I said, these are not necessarily correct chronologically,
mm-hmm.
but those are 4 of the names that are right there at the top. That I recall. I guess I don't.
Yeah, no, that's good. Just kind of who was there and sort of where dispatch was, because dispatch now is over at the sort of fire clinic area.
Yeah.
Which was the resource, which was where the science center was at that time.
That's all grown up a lot since I was working there.
Yeah.
And a much smaller operation.
Yeah, yeah. Backcountry. So were you overseeing roughly the same number of people, or did that number go up?
As the park grew or what?
No, from Yosemite coming to Grand Canyon.
Oh, I think... when I went out from the Valley District to Mather at Yosemite, in terms of my involvement with as a supervisor, I probably went down in sheer numbers supervising people at Mather.
Right.
But my responsibilities sort of in theory broadened. So when I went to the Grand Canyon, I was overseeing probably the same number, if not more, but I had 6 or 7 more major balls to keep in the air.
Got it.
Which I enjoyed. I mean, the more I did that, the better off I liked it. I was the fire chief, wildland structural. And in Yosemite, I actually had developed, a fair expertise, certainly in ranger circles. Fair expertise in structural fire. I would be a sheer rookie on any fire department, on any metropolitan fire department elsewhere, but in ranger circles, I was pretty competent.
And the engines that you used for fire suppression for structural in residential fire control, were they housed at the maintenance yard?
Well, the old maintenance yard.
Yes, what is now the old maintenance yard, but at the time, for you guys, it would have been right across the street from the Albright Training Center?
Correct.
And was there an old maintenance yard at that time, which was, would have been just up the hill from Ranger Operations? I'm just trying to think about, because there was...
You mean up by the school someplace?
No, across the street from the gas station and up the hill there. So from your offices, if you hiked south up.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Center.
The corrals were?
Yeah, the corrals and the blacksmith shop in there, and there was a little warehouse in there. I think that was the first maintenance area.
That was the first warehouse for sure.
Okay.
And probably there was some maintenance aspects to it as well. That was always one of our big concerns, was what happens if we get a fire in this old warehouse, which at the time was the only warehouse. We were still using it.
Hmm.
But it was dry and, probably... This would have been 1981 or 82. This might have been this building was 50 or 60 years old at that time and was a fire trap waiting to happen, but that's what the park had.
Right.
So, you know, we go over there and, you know, periodically try to, you know, do some pre-planning on fire. If the fire starts, you know, who's doing what to whom on this deal.
Right.
And the company had a little fire department, which they combined into the security. Tom Doerr was the head of it while I was there.
And this would have been Fred Harvey being run by AMFAC? Or
no. No, I don't think so. I think it's still Fred Harvey. I mean, you would know better than I, but I don't remember AMFAC at that point, maybe.
Or TRW Services, some.
You don't think it was Fred Harvey itself, huh?
I thought they took off in the 70s or 60s.
Well, I would never dispute any of that.
I don't know. I'm not sure. But Tom Doerr, what do you remember about Tom?
Well, Tom was a retread ranger. He, I think, retired as a GS-9 in the park. Good guy, intellectually fun to be around. Drank way too much. He was a competent river runner. Was one of the early Park Service ranger boatmen. And I think he really enjoyed that. I think he spent a fair amount of time on the river, rowing, the river. So I think he was very competent that way. And he was a good field ranger. He had sort of, I think, lost his edge, partially because of the drinking. He lived in the park, of course. And I liked Tom. In fact, Tom and I would get together. I don't drink, but I would, go up maybe after hours, and he'd still be around his office.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd sit and just gossip and talk about things to do both professionally as well as avocationally. I like Tom. I mean, uh-huh. Tom was a good guy.
Nice.
So one thing that a lot of your, whoever might read or hear this, but the helicopter operation used to run out of the maintenance yard, the old maintenance yard. And it was right next to the firehouse. I mean, you know, this is long building across from the training center.
Yes.
And the gas pumps were behind the building, and then there was the road shop and plumbing shop, and the carpenters had their operation out of there, and the paint, you know, the guys that painted were there. And at the other end of this long building, at the very end was a little firehouse. We had sort of an old styled, but still very good fire truck
okay.
that was in there. And then next to that, we would house the helicopter. And at the end of the day, and not every day, but most every day, we would put that put the helicopter up on rollers, and we would. Three of us or so would wheel it into this shed, not shed, it was this long building, into this room, and that's where the helicopter would be stationed overnight. But this yard is where the helicopter would land, and it, again, by today's standards, it was pretty minimal. It was, didn't have, the real safety specs and for clearances and what have you that we should have. I got permission to take down a few trees in the area that the pilots had to come in from a certain direction in order to land safely.
Right.
And we ran, every time we had to sling load stuff down the Phantom or sling load things in for the water pipeline or any of that sort of thing, we did all the sling loading and loading right there in that maintenance yard. And I mentioned I was a hands-on supervisor. There are any number of times when I would tell you know, I had a couple of people working for me in the helicopter operations, in addition to the pilot. I mean, that, you know, they'd want to do something or we'd be shorthanded. And I said, well, you go do it. You know, I'll cover for you on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been my day off. Now, at this point, I was divorced.
Mm.
But it you know, might have been my day off. But I'll go up and take care of, because we got some sewing loads coming in. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, whatever.
When people came out of the canyon on search and rescue mission, say they were ill or somehow hurt themselves, would the helicopter land right at the clinic, or would it land there in the maintenance yard and then a ground ambulance take them over to the clinic?
Well, both.
Okay.
And if it was really sort of a life and death hurry up thing, we would land at the clinic and right in front of the clinic, right in front of the front door.
Okay.
And there was a little, you know, landscaped island in front of the clinic.
Right.
Which used to have some trees in it.
Yep.
And I got those cut down.
Okay.
I it wasn't like I necessarily asked permission, but I did let people, you know, this is what I'm going to do. And, you know, speak now or forever hold your peace, because those trees are coming down because
right.
they're way too dangerous.
Right.
And it wasn't like there are 300-foot ponderosa pines, but they did pose a real danger to the helicopter route.
So the clinic had emergency entrance on the side, on the west side, and it had a pharmacy and a waiting room entrance kind of on the, I guess I want to say the south side, if I have it right.
Right.
Did the helicopter then land on the emergency door side?
Oh, you know, I'd have to actually see a real diagram to make sure, Tom. But,
okay.
But it was more, I think, more towards the real front door.
Oh, all right.
If I remember right. But, you know, because we were going with what kinds of spaces we had. We
right.
had a parking lot. And pretty quickly, I think we started trying to get cars to park, you know, particularly employees to park a little bit off to the side so we could use that open space for a landing spot.
Right.
But all of that landing was really pretty iffy. Again, by today's standards, I think the pilots felt okay about doing it, but, you know, since I oversaw the helicopter operation, as well as the fixed wing, for that matter, you know, I was very interested in making sure the pilots were comfortable, because they're the ones doing the hard work, and I didn't want them to feel any more jeopardized than they were. But if it was, but on many occasions, we would just land back at the regular old heliport.
Okay.
And transport if we needed to.
Who were the pilots? Do you remember?
No, this is where you need to get a hold of Mike Ebersole.
Okay.
No, I mean, if I thought about it, you know, for a while, I could probably come up with, well, actually, one was Tom. Oh, Jesus. He got killed in a helicopter crash in Flagstaff, mid-air collision.
Yeah.
Long after I retired. Tom, it'll come to me. But they were like, John Fibony was our pilot for a little bit.
Okay.
And, you know, he's the one that was the pilot when the mid-air collision over the canyon.
And how do you spell Thibony?
Thybony. His brother is, you know, Scott Thibony.
Right.
So John would fly periodically. We had, two pilots that were, two. And you know, they'd rotate. One would be pretty much 5 days a week, perhaps, and the other one might be 2 days a week. One pilot we had last name was Roman, and he actually was a pilot for the Arizona Highway Patrol, or Department of Public Safety, out of Flagstaff. But he was sort of moonlighting, and we used him on, you know, some frequency. His wife was, or I guess his previous wife, had worked in the park at one time.
Okay. You know what? I wonder if this is a good place to wrap up this interview, because I think the next question I'm going to want to know is about what kind of ship you had and what kind of missions you made with that, and that might take us a while.
Okay.
Is there anything else you want to add to this before we wrap this up, and then we'll head off in that direction next time?
No, I mean, the helicopter operation at the Grand Canyon was really interesting. It was intense, and it was, it wasn't necessarily at night, but it was sort of 24/7 operation.
Well, I'd like to learn more about that next time.
Well, if we don't have phone trouble,
yeah,
we couldn't do that.
Yeah. Well, in that case, we will conclude Part 11, Oral History Interview with Butch Farabee. Today is Tuesday, June 23rd, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Butch, thank you so very much.
Well, my pleasure.